Where the need to debunk things comes in is the idea that there is a petrodollar system.
So today we've got what looks to be, perhaps, maybe we'll give you a little chance to say maybe not here at the end of the show, but what we got today is the conclusion of our three-part conversation, really, with financial analyst Jason Purcell on the petrodollar system, or the theory behind it. So Jason, like I said, is a financial analyst, and he's working on a book about the history of money in banking, which will also include at least a chapter on the petrodollar system and why it's so important in our understanding. But without any further ado, let's get this show on the road. The Brian D. O'Leary Show, starting right now.
The whole reason that we're still the world reserve currency, if it would have gone kaput, had it not been for the petrodollar system, because that's really the implication that we're talking about here.
The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your home for serious content amidst an unserious culture. So today we're just going to dive on into the deep end. Spent the first two shows building up what you want to present us with today. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah. However, I was doing my notes here this morning and going over this stuff. And there's a few things I want to clear up before we kind of dive back into the history. And one of those things is the petrodollar theory and what it means. So if that sidetracks this history part of the conversation, we'll just have to have you back on again, which I welcome.
But sounds good.
Yeah. So two things. Last episode, you wanted to give us some concrete examples or academic examples of things that are backed by debt or could be backed by debt. And we'll do that in a bit here. But first, what I want to get to is this whole idea of the petrodollar. Or petrocurrency, if it's not the U.S. dollar or whatever, the petro, and what it is, and et cetera. So doing a little research, there's, and I think Wikipedia, of all places, put it this way, where these are three distinct meanings, often confused. So I kind of made a concise redefinition of this. What the petrocurrency is. The first would be revenues from petroleum exports or dollars paid to oil producing nations. What we talked about in the past, I think also called petrodollar recycling. One of the problems I have with this definition, if they're calling it that, is that you use the term to define the term. Which is
a good old circular definition. Yeah, that's the worst.
Kind of insane. So that bothered me. Second kind of meaning or definition would be that it's the petrodollar is defined as a currency of oil producing nations that fluctuate with the price of oil or fall with the price of oil.
That's interesting.
Thus, the petrodollar. You know, you call it the petrodollar because it's tied to petroleum, essentially. That's what I'm getting out of that. Third would be that we price all oil in U.S. dollars. So therefore, currencies, if they're U.S. dollars or not, those currencies are used as a unit of account to price oil in the international market. And this Wikipedia and others have said that these are distinct meanings, often confused. I think they're just confusing. So, first question is that analysis even on mark, is it missing the point?
Well, I'm kind of with you that you got three different ideas here. And I think the problem is that ultimately you're dealing with like a socio-political idea, right? So it's not like, you know, define a column. You know, I'm just using that as an example because I'm looking at a column on my front porch. There's certain attributes of a column that you can define, or any word, you know, just pick one. But petrodollar is a socio-political, idea. And it really just depends on what kind of, you know, what are you really talking about?
Right.
So I got on this subject, and I think this is a good time to really explain, you know, why this is important.
Yeah.
So the initial reason that I got on this subject was in regard to the US dollar status as the world reserve currency, right? And so petrodollar could either be a thing, and I think that there's really multiple definitions. So if you say that, I think the most straightforward way to define petrodollar is just a dollar received for the sale of oil by a non-United States country. You wouldn't have to, you know, you wouldn't have to put that classifier on there. But that's what it's really relevant to. So you could say a dollar received in the sale of oil by, you know, and specifically an Arab exporting state.
Okay. So it's
money
that's washed, to an
oil exporter.
Money that's essentially washed by the US, going from the barrel of oil to, like, I think an example in the past was to buy a pair of Chinese sneakers. It's washed through the US. Is that would technically be?
I don't know. You know, money is so fungible.
Well, that's my point is with asking this question. It's like, why do you have to define something? Or why is this? Why are people so hung up on the idea of a petrodollar? Mm-hmm. When
it could just as easily be a soybean dollar, right? The United States sells a lot of
it. It could
soybeans.
Be anything, but the only it thing it's not, dollar. The only thing it's not is a gold dollar.
That's true.
Really? Yeah, that's that's the only thing it's not. I think you said as a sociopolitical idea, I just kind of see this as the labeling something as a petrodollar because the kind of zeitgeist or whatever, at least since the probably 1970s, has been for the uppity class, if you put it that way, to demonize big oil, demonize mm-hmm. energy production, demonize the United States government, no matter what you say. I mean, I'm demonizing the United States government. I think largely incompetent folks run it, but I'm not demonizing it insofar as these other folks are. It's just a way to throw shade at people. And then the big oil companies, they're providing us with oil. Granted, they might do some nefarious things otherwise, but to kind of group all this activity from oil, the Mideast and everything, and then just label it with something called the petrodollar because the US economy is run on oil, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're here to debunk that idea.
Certainly not the idea that economies run on energy. I would hate to try to debunk that idea because that's certainly
no, but oil proper, yeah,
So the idea that I really wanted to drill into, and in fairness, this used to be my framework for understanding the dollar's role in the world as well. You know, up until probably a couple years ago, having done all of this research and the historical digging myself, my framework for understanding the dollar's role in the world was essentially that we derive, the dollar derives its power, its world dominance through the fact that it is the only currency that oil is priced in and sold for.
Okay.
Now we can separate a couple of these things out, right? So a petrodollar, okay, I'm from the US, or let's make it even better. I'm from Japan and I need to buy $1 million worth of oil from Saudi Arabia. So I trade my yen for US dollars and I spend the million and I, you know, send it to the Saudis and then they send me the oil. You could very easily call that a petrodollar. Okay,
okay.
Fair enough. I think that the reason that it is a concept in the first place and we don't have, like, you know, sneaker dollars or wheat dollars or soybean dollars or anything like that is just the simple fact that oil, especially in the 70s when that term was coined, is an especially politically sensitive and important commodity. And there's no, I would say that, I think it's pretty fair to say that there really has not been an example of another commodity that's really just that's been a linchpin the way that oil has in our history. Maybe bronze, you know, if you go back 3,000 years, right? you know, so you know, it's kind of the bronze of the day. That's one way to think about it. But the reason that I wanted to drill into this is petrodollars exist. Fine.
We'll stipulate that petrodollars in some way, shape or form exist, no matter how you define it.
Yeah. I will stipulate that if you really want to define this dollar as a petrodollar, because it's a dollar spent on oil, you know, even though, by the way, if Japan needs to import rubber from Thailand, chances are they're also going to use dollars for that, right?
Sure.
It's not just when they need to import oil. If Japan needs to buy rubber for their Toyota tires from Thailand, they're also going to use dollars. And whenever a country like Brazil imports wheat from Ukraine, they also use dollars. And whenever all these countries import all these things from each other, they also use dollars. But if you really want to identify these particular dollars by the product that they were received in revenue for, then I will concede that there are such thing as petrodollars. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's dollars that foreigners spend on, you know, Arab oil.
Right. So if you go back in history, we talked about, I think the first episode we did about the pound sterling and how the sterling or even the Dutch going back, I don't know if it was on our
the
show,
Dutch guilder.
But yeah, the Dutch guilder was the main currency that Europeans traded in. And I think it was another podcast you were on with probably Monica Perez, where you kind of go into detail on that. But I think because they had the most solid banks and people, it was a trust. And that's where we are with the U.S. currency. Mm-hmm. No matter how untrustworthy the government or the dollar itself is, it's like the skinniest kid at fat camp. You know,
the skinniest kid at fat camp, the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry, the healthiest cake, you know, whatever analogy you want to use.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Yeah. So we're stipulating that it exists, however you want to define that. And,
Where the need, I think, to debunk things comes in is the idea that there is a petrodollar system.
Okay.
Right? So, This is a way of thinking that is really common in what I call, and maybe this isn't the best word for it, but for lack of a better term, right, the liberty community.
Sure.
So libertarian podcasters and influencers and things like that. It's very common to hear the petrodollar as the framework for why the United States still continues to be the monetary hegemon. And so the narrative to that, there is a specific narrative that has been explained a bunch of times and in a few different ways, but there's a narrative to the petrodollar, to the idea of a petrodollar system. And there's a way of, you know, it's like, you got to have evidence for this. And if there's no evidence that this happened, then, you know, we can't use this as a framework anymore. And by the way, why is this important in the first place is, again, the reason that I got into this to begin with was because when Russia invaded Ukraine in March or February 2022, the U.S. and the I don't remember if it's the G10 or the G7, they get together and they basically extricate, I hope I'm using that term correctly, they eradicate Russia from their financial systems. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very important signal to Russia that says, you know, Russia is a commodity-rich nation. They sell a lot of energy. They export a lot of energy. So Russia now is going to be exporting oil and gas for other currencies. And then once that happened, and then the other thing that happened around the same time is March 2022, you have Zoltan Poser, who is a former expert from the New York Fed, who's written a lot about the shadow banking systems and how the machinery of the financial system works. And he's, by the way, a great resource for that. He's got a PhD in economics, and that was his specialty. But he had a conference with his employer at the time, who's no longer around, Credit Suisse. And in that conference, he said, I am expecting that there is going to be a bifurcation in the global money system. The global dollar market, the global dollar is going to get a lot weaker, which means in general, the dollar is going to get a lot weaker. Its use case, its frequency of use is going to go down a lot. And we're going to start to see commodity-backed currencies administered by these powers like the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa.
Okay.
So he poses at this conference that, you know, these things are all going to happen. And our community, especially, you know, the Liberty community, really chomped down on that and said, oh, you know, this is the end of the dollar. It's all kaput. As soon as the Saudis, you started to see these news stories about the Saudis would have the Chinese to Riyadh to negotiate a contract for the Saudis to sell some oil to the Chinese government for yuan instead of dollars. India buying, oil being sold to other countries around the world for contracts that are being sold or that are being settled in currencies other than the dollar. And so if the petrodollar system is your framework, which essentially just means that the reason that the US dollar is the world reserve currency is that it is the only one that oil is priced and sold for. And so if that's your framework, then you see those news headlines, you see all of these countries looking at other currencies to trade their oil for, and you say, oh, the US dollar hegemony is kaput. You know, it's over. This is how it ends.
Right. But you you mentioned in the one of the last times we spoke is that there was never an agreement.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So the story goes, I think we were just before the Saudi oil embargo of 1973, the last time that we spoke. But yeah, the story goes, so Nixon pulls us off the gold standard in 1971. For the next 2 to 3, you know, the only value to the dollar up until that point is it's the last currency on earth that's, you know, backed by gold effectively. Right. But there are stipulations in the conditions of the International Monetary Fund, the Bretton Woods system broadly, where other countries would settle gold with each other. It really wasn't just the US, but that's a whole different rabbit hole. but anyway, so the US currency, it's the, you know, basically the last one for, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's the last one on earth that's backed by gold. Nixon takes us off the gold standard in 1971.
Right.
This petrodollar theory usually goes, okay, so the Saudis and the other oil states, they start doubting the performance of the dollar as a safe store of value. And the dollar did fall against other currencies after 1971 and in the years after. So there's, you know, that's is perfectly fine to speculate on that or whatever. There's a Saudi oil embargo in October 1973 because there's a conflict between Egypt and Israel. And whenever that happens, the Saudis have to basically tell the Muslim world, you know, we're on the right side. So we're not going to sell oil to the U.S. anymore, or anybody that we know is an ally of the U.S. You know, they're not going to get any more of our oil. And the embargo didn't actually last very long. It was over by March 1974, so about 6 months. In total, actually, it might have even been January. I'd have to go back and look to it. So it's a period of months. The story goes that somewhere around the time of the oil embargo, when the U.S. is struggling because we're dealing with really high inflation and the value of our currency is falling, which also contributes to inflation, policymakers, specifically Henry Kissinger, and then the other one that's mentioned is Secretary of the Treasury William Simon, go to Saudi Arabia. They go to Riyadh, quote unquote, hat in hand. I've read that in some accounts.
Right.
To make a deal with the Saudis that if you allow us to provide you with protection, you know, we will protect you, we'll protect your borders and fund your military. Then if you will only price and sell dollar or sell oil exclusively for US dollars. So the policymakers are saying we need to create a bid for US dollars because these other countries around the world are starting to doubt us and they're dumping our currency, blah, blah, blah. So if you only sell and price oil in dollars, then we will fund your military, your security, and make sure that your state is secure. We make that deal with the Saudis. And that is the quote unquote petrodollar agreement that I can't find any even corollary evidence ever happened. Right.
Okay.
And then,
hang on. Like we talked about this last time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit. You mentioned that. And you mentioned that, you know, there's no agreement, but who's reporting what? Like, is it just this theory, this made up thing that Kissinger, we'll stipulate he goes to Saudi and meets with a prince or a king or whatever. But
yeah,
but then at the agreement, the agreement after the fact, we don't really No, it was just like kind of a, if there was an agreement, it was like, right, buddy, right? You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. See, it was nothing in writing.
Mm.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what I'm gathering had to have happened.
Yeah. I mean, so you could say that, and that's, look, anybody who wants to say that this is how the world works because these people made this agreement several decades ago, and this is how it is. Some folks are not going to be persuaded with a lack of evidence because they're just going to say, well, it all happened behind closed doors. They don't write about this stuff in the New York Times.
Right.
You know, fine. And it, you know, fair enough. I'm just saying that there has to be, like, you can't see a black hole, but there has to be a distortion of gravity around it. You know, there's a distortion of matter around it, which is how you identify a black hole.
Sure.
And there's just not enough distortions of, even if, you know, let's say they make a completely secret deal, which says, you know, you got, or it's a handshake deal. You guys are only going to sell oil for dollars. You're only going to price oil in dollars, and we're going to fund your military. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Even if that happened, there would still have to, and it, you know, it was completely in secret, you know, you would still have to have your distortions around the black hole to be able to identify that that happened. Otherwise, what is your standard of evidence for anything? You know, like the reason that I believe that the hacks at the World Economic Forum and the Johns Hopkins Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the reason that I believe that they planned the pandemic is because I have a video of Event 201 from October of 2019, where they literally sit down and plan a pandemic, you know, like, like there's evidence there,
right.
You know, is what I'm getting at.
Right.
You have to have something to indicate that these things happen.
Right.
So the missing evidence from this version of 1973-1974, it's like, so between October or between 1971 and 1973, these countries start, you know, they are maybe dumping their dollar assets, and they are threatening the US and they're saying, you better be able to pay us in gold or we're demanding German marks instead of these crappy dollars, blah, blah, blah. And that's part of the narrative. And the solution to that was for the American policymakers to come over and say, hey, can we make a deal with you where you will just take the damn dollars, please? And there's not evidence of that either. Like there's just no, from 1971 to 1973, there's no evidence that the Saudis, the Arab exporters, or anybody else for that matter, was griping about how, I don't want to sell these barrels of oil or I don't want to sell these for American currency anymore because it's not backed by gold. We need to figure out something else. And of course, you could say, well, it was discussed. It just wasn't public. You know, the threats were made
right.
were public. If you want to go that route, fine. But there was a time in 1978 when the Arab exporters, when the Arab oil exporting states, they did get together and they convened a monetary conference in 1978 to figure out an alternative for booking their dollar assets, an alternative for receiving payment for their oil exports. They did talk about it. It was very public. It was in all the papers, and it never got off the ground. It was in 1978, and it was 4 or 5 years after this petrodollar agreement ever supposedly happened.
Okay.
So if this petrodollar agreement happened in 1973, 1974, why are these Gulf states meeting in 1978 to try to decide, hey, maybe we should use a portfolio of currencies instead of just the dollar in order to hold our assets in, you know?
Right.
So that shows you two things. One, if they are worried about the dollar, they would be public about it. So if there had been a problem where the Arab oil exporters were threatening to say, we're not going to take dollars anymore or whatever, there's no reason to believe they wouldn't be public about it, because they were public about it in 1978.
Right.
And then a piece of that is, if they were public about it in 1978, then how good was that agreement from 1973? You know, the petrodollar agreement.
Right. And plus the U.S. government.
Why are they talking about it 5 years later?
Plus the U.S. government, if that was the case, they could have just pulled out of the Middle East or pulled out of Saudi. You know, said, totally. All right, we're no longer got bases and you're on your own, guys.
You're done. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, if that, I guess the petrodollar system as prescribed worked that way. Interesting, like doing a little research on this. I think we'll get to the Suez Canal here thing in a moment, but during the
yeah,
midst,
and if I could just add one or maybe 2 points, what we talked about one or maybe two episodes ago was also an important component to this, is that the U.S. support for the Saudi military started, you know, almost, it was during World War II. I mean, one of the last things that FDR did as president was meet with the Saudi king. And then we started to build bases in Saudi in 1946. And we inked agreements to continue construction and improvement on their military in throughout the 1950s. Like, there was a renewal of that agreement in 1956. There was another one in 66, 67. So there's, up to this point, you know, this is by no means, and that's another component of this theory, I think, is the idea that this is not only the genesis of the dollar being backed by oil, is the genesis of the Arabs, of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, where they're kind of our protectorate. And we know from all the things that we've gone over that was 20 years in the making already.
Already. Right? Yeah. It had already been, the cake is baking in the oven.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a long time. Yeah. So in that time period, I know we're not, we're talking mostly U.S., but I found it interesting. You mentioned the embargo was the U.S. primarily, and a lot of the other Western nations that were allied with Washington to some degree. But interesting, Spain got out, was able to get oil during that time due to the future King Juan Carlos' relationship with Saudi and other Gulf state princes and stuff. He's very entrenched with those folks. So I thought that was a very interesting thing. And I didn't know that either until last week. And and so that's interesting. But he abdicated the throne in favor of his son in, I think it was 2014 now, something like that. But he now lives. I mean, he had a bunch of scandals too, but he now lives in one of the Emirates.
Does he really?
Because he's been insinuated in that whole oil thing. He made a bunch of money outside of himself, whatever salary he is as a king, or if he gets any, in this whole mix up with all the oil, in just playing politics, essentially, is what it came down to. So the whole thing, and I mentioned to you, I think offline or another time, but Spain had lost most of its gold reserves during the Spanish Civil War, which went to Moscow,
right?
Because they couldn't pay for anything other than with gold, or like, we're talking this Will Saudi take anything but dollars? Moscow wouldn't take anything but gold. So the entire, you know, Spanish Empire, that their wealth that collapsed. Had been built up since the discovery of the Americas and stuff, that went to Moscow. And now,
yeah,
King Juan Carlos is clawing it a little bit back with this oil money in the 70s, and boosts Spain's prominence in the world. But the point being is that now Moscow, they did whatever they could. They squandered that whole, whatever gold reserves, most of their gold reserves, I would imagine, with the communist experiment. And then we get into this point now, okay, all the Western nations are highly dependent. All nations now are highly dependent on oil, 1971 or something. And then we're back here with the Saudi, we're right in the midst of the Saudi oil embargo, roundabout way of getting there. But
yeah, and that's really fascinating about the Spanish, because it kind of makes sense, because there's this idea that the colonial powers of Europe are all colonial powers and they're all wealthy, but there's a pretty big distribution between Britain and France versus, or even Britain versus France versus Spain versus Portugal. Those countries, for all of the, pillaging and plundering that they did,
right,
of South America in the 1400s and 1500s, they really don't have a whole lot to show for it.
Well, not anymore. So, no. Yeah. And then you got Belgium, Germany, Belgium and Germany in Africa. Well, their entire fortunes were lost, spending on World War I and World War II, and they're trying to claw that back. And then eventually they said, oh, this is a fool's errand to be down in Africa trying to colonize things. And so, essentially what we got now in a weird way is this colonization of the Middle East without people. Mm-hmm. Essentially, we're doing the same thing without sending people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was, as soon as it was found out that the Saudis had oil under the ground, there was a big push in the 50s, immediately post-war era, to make deals with the Saudis for preferential treatment in the sale of that oil. Fortunately, I mean, the deal that the deal that they were able to make for exclusive drilling rights for half a century,
yeah,
was just, I mean, literally the deal of a lifetime.
Sure.
I mean, it's completely unbelievable that now, and they didn't find commercial quantities for the, for the first several years that they had that agreement, but eventually they came. Literally the deal of the century.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about the Suez Canal crisis, the oil embargo?
Yeah.
And how that plays in. And we'll see how that goes. I don't know if we'll be able to make it all the way up to the present, but tell me how all that plays in to this whole petrodollar system and lack thereof.
So the Suez Canal became a point of contention in the 1967 war when Israel took over the Sinai Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And so once they had the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, which is not a huge concern anymore because Egypt and Israel, at least on paper, have made peace and they have not been at war with each other for many years. But that's where the lines were drawn. Not officially, that's where Israel drew the lines as a result of the 1967 war. And Egypt said, well, okay, if you want the Sinai Peninsula, then we'll just shut down the whole damn Suez Canal. So for 6 or 7 years, I want to say from 1967 all the way through 1973, there was no operational Suez Canal. It was completely shut off. And they did it so abruptly that there were actually ships loaded with cargo ready to get out of the canal and go to their destinations that were just left there abandoned for that entire time. And so this is a, this Middle East policy thing is really front of mind for Americans at the time, because even before 1971, this is, you know, whatever it is, I look at inflation as the most proximate causes being money printing, you know, the inflation of the money supply, leading to price inflation. That's your number one factor. But you also, there are, when you have inflationary money and supply chain hangups, like a closure in the Suez Canal, and you combine those two, you can get a pretty nasty inflation spiral. And that's what was happening in the US. So you have a supply shock, the Suez Canal is shut down. So if oil tankers are going to make it, you know, out of the Middle East, they're not going to be able to take that efficient route. They're going to have to go around whatever it is, Cape Horn, I think, whatever is around Africa or
Cape of
the
Good
Mediterranean,
Hope.
Whatever. Good Hope. Yeah, I think that's right. So that drives up costs. You add extremely inflationary money on top of that, and you get this inflation. And prices were already increasing in the United States from 1967 to 1971. Inflation was even though economists at the time blamed the embargo itself, 1973, or they would blame the Carter administration's handling of the hostage crisis in 1979. They would blame these individual things for inflation, but it was really already getting going by the time 1971 rolled around. I read a newspaper article where the head of the Department of Commerce or the Department of Labor, one of those, was commenting on how, or the Times was commenting on how whenever the head of the Department of Labor gave a conference about inflation or something, his forecasts for food prices were always too low. His forecasts for food inflation were always too low. Like a year before, he had said food prices were going to go up 5% and they went up 15%, right? That kind of
thing. Well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned the inflationary money and supply chain problems, and then you have a supply chain spiral and all sorts, and an inflationary spiral. I mean, just look at what happened in 2020.
Yeah, just look a couple years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. It's exact same scenario you paint out, except you're using some gummed up pandemic response as opposed to the, like a Suez Canal supply chain, you know, shut down. Suez Canal shut down. I mean, it's like, of course, they're different things, but like the amount of activity, economic activity grinds down to close to a halt for, I mean, we all remember that time. There was very little economic activity that we're used to. And so that's very similar. I wasn't around then, but very similar to what I gather happened in the early 70s, thus the bell bottoms and the bad music and...
Yeah, there's all kinds of intersection between, you know, money and inflation and culture. So, you know, maybe disco would never have existed without the great inflation. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. But so this Middle East policy and the warfare state and especially what's happening with Israel, because this is when, you know, the U.S. kind of has to maintain an alliance with the Saudis, because we have made an agreement with them going back to post-World War II that we're going to build up their military. But at the same time, we have to be, you know, Israel's sword and shield in the Middle East. We have to fund them because they're our allies. So this, you know, this whole Middle East policy thing is just whack. And it still is, you know, like look at Middle East policy now.
Right.
It just is. But at this time in particular, because it's happening at the same time as, you know, 1971, we're pulling off the gold standard and the great inflation. That's just what makes all of these things more economically hyper-focused. So, and it's interesting because we might see, just putting things up to present day, we may see another closure of the Suez Canal with what's going on in Yemen.
Yeah, okay.
So that would be an interesting experiment, you know, to see what the effects would be. But the real crux of, I think the way to summarize the petrodollar system idea is like, are there petrodollars? Yeah. we spend money on oil, and when Japan buys oil, and when China buys oil, and when all of these other countries in the world buy oil, they spend dollars to buy it. And so you have, as a result, you have these dollars that stack up with these Arab oil exporting states. They are dollars, their bank account balance is in dollars. And so you could call those petrodollars. Is there a petrodollar system? That's, you know, that's really the question that I'm concerned with, because if the dollar derives its value from, you know, if the whole reason that we're still the world reserve currency, if it would have gone kaput had it not been for the petrodollar system, because that's really the implication that we're talking about here, right? If you believe that the dollar as the hegemon derives that position from the global oil trade and just the fact that it's the currency that oil is bought and sold for, then you're going to think that any breakage in that system is going to crash the dollar. Like that's okay. That's going to end our status as a global reserve currency.
I guess the question here, really, like you mentioned it, is does the US dollar derive its worth from the global oil trade? If so, the petrodollar system is true. If not, I mean, you could think of a million reasons why that's not true, right? I mean, it's a huge factor, right? We're not denying that, but it's not, I don't believe that its entire worth flows from the global oil trade. It just, like, from everything you've said, there's so many more factors going into what the dollar,
it comes down to this. It's like there's an implication that I never see made when I talk about the petrodollar, when I hear or read, you know, a description, a narrative of the petrodollar system. There's an implication there that it's like the rest of the countries in the world are not only buying oil for dollars, but they're buying everything else for dollars
too.
And the implication is they're buying everything else in dollars because they're buying oil in dollars. But there's really no reason that that should be the case, right? There's never, if dollars are expensive, okay, if it's not, and historically since 1970, even though, you know, the dollar has fluctuated in value a lot, there are plenty of places around the world where the dollar is expensive and it gets more and more expensive, which simply means Sri Lanka is a good example. Russia is a very good example. The value of the ruble in terms of against the dollar has gone way, way down since especially 2014, but since tensions really flared between the US and Russia. The value of the Sri Lankan, I think it's a rial or a rupee, the Sri Lankan rupee has gone down a lot against dollars. There's all kinds of countries all over the world where dollars are extremely expensive. So if you know that you have to budget that, like you know that you have to pay dollars in order to get oil, then you're not going to just voluntarily say, like, there's no convenience or economy of scale here. It doesn't benefit you to buy everything else for dollars too, is the point I'm getting at. There's no benefit to you. It must be because the person on the other side of the trade is demanding dollars.
Or there's no deal. You know,
there's no deal,
but you could find a deal. Like, yeah, you could. Yeah, it's just a matter of trade and negotiation, really. When it comes down to it, it's like, what are you going to take? Well, I'm going to take this. Well, I've got, or it's just bad negotiation on the part of these countries or these companies within these countries that they're so cowed by the ostensible power of the U.S. government and thus the U.S. dollar. That, you know, at that point, it's like you're a bad negotiator, I guess. We might need to get some more people in power, elected or not.
And raw power is a part of it.
I think that's what we're talking about, really.
Yeah, it is. It's not everything, right?
Right. Just like oil's not everything.
It's not everything. It is no coincidence that when a lot of the world's trade was being done in Dutch guilders, the Dutch were in charge and managing a great deal of the world's shipping lanes.
Yes,
it's not a coincidence that when people were settling trade in pound sterling, that the British were controlling and managing a lot of the world's shipping lanes. You know, that's definitely a factor. But the thing also to think about it for everybody to sort of add to your framework here. So this was best said by Warren Mosler, who you'll probably know as the MMT guy.
Yeah.
And I don't particularly agree with a whole lot that Warren Mosler says, because I'm not an MMT person or anything like that, but he is very intelligent and tends to just kind of have a good way of explaining things sometimes. But he said, the way that he puts this is that also it doesn't matter what currency you trade in, it matters what currency you save in, right? So let's posit that the Saudis sold oil for dollars, but once they got the dollars, they didn't actually prefer to hold dollars for savings. Well, then effectively what would happen? So let's say that the buyer is Chinese. So let's say that it's a Chinese refiner, Sinopec. I think that's one of the big Chinese oil companies.
Yeah.
I'm just remembering that from a couple years ago when I did whatever. So let's say Sinopec buys $1 million of oil from Saudi Arabia, you know, Aramco, and Aramco gets $1 million, but they would prefer to invest in some other currency. Let's call it, you know, because the whole thing has been about BRICS lately, let's just call it Russian, you know, bonds, or they want to, or something, I don't know. They want to invest in something besides, you know, besides dollars. So they're then going to sell the dollars, right, against some other currency or reals or whatever. Let's say that they just want to have a balance of rubles. They're going to sell the dollar against the ruble. And then the value of the dollar, even though, here's the point, the value of the dollar, even though it was used in that trade, even though it was used for the Chinese to buy the oil from Aramco, if Aramco then wishes to get rid of the dollars after they have them, then the fact that the dollar was spent on the oil doesn't confer any strength to the dollar, because as soon as the Saudis make the decision to get rid of those dollars, the dollar's price is going back down, right? So you got a beneficial, the Chinese had to convert some yuan to dollars, and they do so. Yeah. They spend $1 million. The Saudis get $1 million. Or let's just say that the Saudis want to convert them to Saudi rials, their own currency.
Sure.
Well, then the dollar is going to go down against the Saudi rial.
So well, if I guess make it even simpler, I could be wrong here, but it replaces barter. So,
oh well, that yeah. You know, well, that's so the function of money in general, for sure.
Right, right. So you could you could say, all right, I'm going to trade it for this amount of Russian, like you call it, Russian rubles or whatever. But that is like way too hard to deal with. Like I got to find some guy to do this, and like some other bank to accommodate that. Meanwhile, like everybody else is transacting in dollars, so might as well do dollars, and then, like you're saying, save in this other currency if you so choose, if that's worth it. I don't know that it is, but yeah, I would also say that that's often what's happening. We had Wesley Schlemmer on the show a little bit ago, and he's involved in the Bitcoin thing, and he's like, yeah, I'm trying to make my whole life Bitcoin and transact in Bitcoin, you know, pay my bills in Bitcoin. It's like, I just can't do it. It's just not available to me. So what I do is like, I get my Bitcoin that you give me for talking to you or consulting and, you know, doing all these other things. I go out and sell my Bitcoin on the open market for US dollars. And then I pay my bills with that.
Yep.
And then I go back to using my Bitcoin. It's not the Bitcoin dollar system. It's just, that's the way, it's hard not to transact these days in the US dollar. I mean, I guess really is, yeah. I mean, we're Americans here. Speaking of that, of course, it's all we know, but I can only imagine because you just all these other countries. It's so the US dollar is insinuated in every single economy, no matter what.
Yeah. It's in 90% of FX transactions. The dollar is one leg of the trade. So even if, let's say that I'm Swiss and I have francs and what I need is Chinese yuan, I'm not going to make the currency conversion directly from Swiss francs to yuan. I'm going to convert it to dollars because there's no market to convert Swiss francs directly to yuan.
Right.
Right. I'm going to convert it to dollars. I'm going to convert the francs to dollars. And then I'm going to convert the dollars to yuan because there's a market for that. I can make it happen.
And it's kind of a pain, but like nowadays computers can take care of all that stuff a lot faster than like some dude with a monocle. So like we talked about last time, like settling up his trades at the end of the day in some big room. Mm-hmm. Like that stuff can happen almost instantaneously, or you got to wait for a good trade. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I would put it even, maybe even simpler or more just in kind of economics-y terms. It's, you know, the fact of the matter is that when these trades are made, when global trade is paid for, a lot of the time, you know, all of these payments are being facilitated by banks. And where do banks get funded, right? Like, what are they? Banks do two things. They are storehouses of wealth. So you have, I mean, broadly speaking, right? Everybody knows they don't actually have your money, right? But you store, quote unquote, you store your money there, and they also lend money, right? Those are their two functions. Whenever trade is done, in the vast majority of cases, you're using some kind of very short-term credit, and this is going back centuries, using very short-term credit in order to make these transactions happen. It's pay now, settle later. You're going to a bank, and not only are you asking for a currency conversion, but at the same time, you're probably getting something like some kind of export or import credit at the same time. Well, how do banks get funded? They get funded with savings. They get funded with, and these are global banks.
Right.
So they get savings from all around the world, from businesses, rich people, poor people all around the world. And so what is that funding going, you know, why are they issuing credit in dollars and why are they making markets in dollars? It's because that's what their funding is. And this goes back to their funding is dollars. Their funding is the globe's supply of saved dollars. And why does that globe's supply of saved dollars exist? It goes back to the idea of it doesn't matter what currency you trade in. It matters what currency you save in.
Okay.
There's millions and billions of people and institutions all around the world that prefer to save in dollars. And so what they put in banks is dollars, and what the banks are willing to make markets in for the global financial system to do its thing and for global trade to do its thing, they're going to make those markets in dollars.
Okay.
It's, you know, ultimately it all comes from the desire of the individual or the desire of the company or whatever deciding. And again, it's not completely like economics in isolation. There are state powers too, right? We talked about how the Dutch controlled the shipping lanes, and it's no coincidence that when the Dutch controlled the shipping lanes, a lot of trade was settled in guilders. When the British controlled the shipping lanes, a lot of trade is settled in sterling. That contributes to it for sure. But ultimately, the people around the world who are responsible for producing and managing wealth, which is literally just everybody, like everybody has a piece of that. All of us produce and manage wealth to some extent, making the decision to allocate that to dollars instead of something else. And so I would just love for, you know, for everybody who thinks, because the deal a year ago, and I think what a lot of folks still is going to happen is that the BRICS are going to tie their currency to gold, and they're going to have a currency basket, which the Saudis and the other oil exporting states are then going to start selling their oil for this BRICS currency basket instead of the USD. And so I would just like, you know, because it's tied to gold or whatever. And so knowing that it doesn't, you know, what's really important is not what currency you trade in, it's what currency you save in, and it's what you desire to hold, you know, not what you're transacting necessarily. I would just like to ask everybody who owns gold and believes in this idea, how much of your gold would you put on deposit in a Russian bank? How much of your gold would you put on deposit in a Chinese bank?
Right.
Is it a high number? Really? Peter Schiff, you hate dollars so much? Tell me how much of your gold, because I know he has a lot.
Yeah.
So I would love for Peter Schiff to tell me how much of his gold that he would put on deposit in a Chinese or Russian bank. I'd love to know that.
Right.
Well, you know what I mean?
Shots fired. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the answer. Maybe Peter can come on.
Well, mine is none. Yeah. I would not put any of my gold.
Yeah, mine's trending to zero also. Yeah. All right. Well, that kind of solves that idea of the petrodollar system. And we didn't get through the entire history. Maybe we can talk about more of this stuff later, because there's questions that come up. They have people asking me, you know, question like, oh, when's the next one coming up with Jason? And I'm like, oh, well, we'll do it soon enough. Just hang on and we'll answer some questions. So out there, folks, if you've got questions, just, and if you're on, especially if you're on like Fountain FM, Fountain.fm, listening to this program, you should just comment and let us know what's going on, what questions we can have you answer next time Jason comes on, because I think we've kind of exhausted the petrodollar system, but there's a lot of analysis that Jason has to offer, and said it before, I think he's one of the most astute minds here on this history and state of money and banking we've got here on our side. So
you are too kind. Thank you.
But the Monica Perez crowd loves you too. So we're of like mind there. But anyway, yeah, just any feedback would be great. And we can do some maybe Q&A next time Jason's on, and we can kind of explore some topics more in depth that might be outside of the oil realm itself.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I do a monthly interest rates and economic outlook that is going to be going out in the next couple of days.
Okay.
So this is going to be the one for January. So if this idea of posting some questions or Q&A, if you have any questions about current events, because I work in financial markets and I study them intimately. So it's not just a historical endeavor. I also keep tabs on what's going on with the present day economy. So if you have any questions also about what's going on, in 2024 or anything more recently, you know, feel free to throw those into. I'd love to help if I can.
And then find Jason at what? jpurcell.me. Is that the best place to go?
Yep. Or I'm back on Twitter. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm Jason's Deli 1821. And that's no punctuation altogether.
Okay.
No underscores or anything like that.
We'll put that in the show notes.
1821 is the year that the British went back on the gold standard after they suspended in 1797. So that's why if I was going to have to, you know, I needed a sequence of four numbers, and that's the one I chose.
Very meta.
Yeah.
We're very X. All right. All right, Jason, we'll chat with you down the road, and appreciate your time here.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye.
Thanks.
For more of our podcasts, head on over to briandeoleary.com. And while you're over there, sign up for our email list. We'll send you daily emails. You can also find the link for our Substack page and various other resource pages we have. And that's at briandeoleary.com. Thinking about starting that new podcast of yours? Having trouble figuring out how to do it, perhaps? Never fear. We were in that same spot a few years back. At O'Leary & Company, we don't have all of it licked. But we've gone through the struggles of setting up those podcasts and those side gigs so that you don't have to. and you can go to OlyrianCompany.com for more details. That's OlyrianCompany.com.